Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Even though you make payroll every Friday, you don't have a guaranteed paycheck. You're a small business owner, and you eat what you kill.
We are back. 16 after. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and I appreciate your business. Our phone number is 888-822-8255. Now, why would you want that number? You might want to call in and talk to the president of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank and a member of the Federal Open Market Committee meeting with the Fed. Bob is a member of the Federal Open Market Committee meeting, as I told you before, and he's the Fed's principal monetary policy, which is the Fed's, I should say, principal monetary policy making body, and we've talked about that before. Bob McTeal, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jim.
It's good to have you back with us, and you guys have been busy since you were with us in December. You raised rates again.
One more time, yes.
But we can't blame that on you, probably, because you didn't get a chance to vote on the last one, did you?
That's right. I vote every third year, and I had a voting year in 99, so I went off at the end of 99.
What can you tell us about what happened, what went on in the last FOMC meeting?
Well, I can't tell you anything about what actually was said there.
Right.
That's confidential.
But I understand.
As you know, the FOMC started a series of tightenings on June 30th. They did that one in June and one in August. I dissented and voted against both of those.
You were the lone dissenter, and for which we congratulate you, small business owners around the country and maybe even around the world. Thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you.
We appreciate that kind of courage.
We skipped October and then did one in November, and then at the beginning of February was the fourth one. So they total only one percentage point because they were real small bites each time.
But now, in the November one, I didn't hear you say you dissented in the November one.
I did not dissent in November for a couple of reasons. One reason was that while the inflation numbers had favored my position up until September, the September inflation numbers were a little bit scary. It turned out to be kind of a one-month spike, and they went back pretty well, but the numbers that I had going for me for a while turned on me a little bit in September. Plus, I think I'd made my point and had an opportunity to state my position, so I didn't want to continue to make a nuisance of myself.
Can you tell us what? And I understand. I can see how that would happen. I mean, you had made your case in the summer based on a certain set of evidence, and that evidence changed a little bit to go the other way, and you had to do what was right. And I understand that. What about in the last meeting? I know you can't tell us what happened, but can you give us an idea for what the fundamental concerns were that would cause you to raise interest rates one more time?
Well, I guess for the majority of the people there, it's simply the momentum of the economy was so great. You may recall that 1999 ended up growing a little over 4% for about the fourth year in a row. But the third quarter growth rate was 5.7% annual rate.
Yeah.
And at the last meeting, the fourth quarter growth rate seemed to be 5.8%. As you probably know, last week they revised that 5.8 up to 6.9, which is almost unheard of.
Why?
So during the whole second half of 1999, the economy was growing faster than almost anybody could imagine as being sustainable. And so there was the feeling that we need to get it down closer to a sustainable rate so that it doesn't sort of blow out.
To the non-economists out there like me and most of my audience, we don't see a growing economy is a problem, but the Fed seems to see it as an automobile, that our vehicle that was taking us to our destination at a very fast pace, but now maybe is getting a little bit unstable and a little bit going too fast, maybe it's so as to be almost dangerous.
That's right. I think my favorite analogy there is to ask the question, why does a race car have brakes?
Yeah.
Obviously, you don't put brakes on a race car to slow it down on average.
Right.
You have the brakes there to get you around the corners and the sharp turns, so that you can go faster on average, but sort of stay on the track when it gets dangerous.
Make the adjustments. Right. Stand by, Bob. We've got to take a break. Folks, we'll be right back. I appreciate your business. And my website is www.smallbusinessadvocate.com. Don't forget to go there and check out some of the new stuff we've got there, including a whole new search engine capability that I think you'll like, and a lot of new articles. And be sure to check those out. And don't forget to sign up for my newsletter while you're there, too. Bob McTeer is our guest, ladies and gentlemen. I'm so excited about having him on the show. He is a member of the Fed, the Federal Reserve Organization. He's the president of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank, and he is a member of the Federal Open Market Committee. And we've been talking to him about interest rates. That was the last thing that we talked about. And Bob, one of the sectors of the economy that is absolutely dedicated and tied to join at the hip to interest rates, whether they're good or bad or indifferent, is the home building industry, because virtually all homes have mortgages, and as rates go down, home building improves. As rates go up, home building takes a little bit of a hit. My question is, with regard to the four rates that you guys have increases that you've made in the last few months, isn't home building takes a long time for you guys to really see the effects of the consequence or the effects of your rate increases on home building. I'm just wondering, how do you look at home building when you're making some of these decisions? How much do you dial in home building into your decision process?
Well, when you change monetary policy, the effect all across the economy is uneven, as you suggest, and home building or home ownership is very interest rate sensitive, but ironically, it's not nearly as sensitive as it used to be. Years ago, you had something called Regulation Q, which limited the amount of interest that banks could pay on deposits. And mm-hmm. Back then, when rates got a little bit higher than that, their funds just dried up, and their lending for homes had to dry up. It was a very abrupt thing. But Regulation Q was finally limited, and we got a lot of secondary mortgage holders so that banks don't just have to hold those mortgages. And so even though home building is still more sensitive than some sectors, it's not nearly as disproportionately impacted as it used to be. And ironically, usually when there's a series of tightening moves, before it hurts home building, it usually helps home building, because there are a lot of people sort of sitting on the fence, and when they see rates going up, their initial reaction, if they were thinking about buying, is to go ahead and buy before they go up anymore.
Right.
So it's sort of an odd response.
But
then it starts depressing a little bit.
Yeah, because what has happened is you've loaded up, you've sort of accelerated or compress some future demand into the current situation, and then, you know, down the road, that's kind of what I was talking about when I said that it takes so long to really see the effects of interest rate increases on home building. And I'm worried, one of the things I'm concerned about is, I know that the Fed is concerned about the stock valuation, I know they're concerned about consumer spending, they're not so much concerned about the Asian contagion, as Mr. Greenspan called it, they're not as concerned about that maybe as you were about, say, 18 months ago or so, but I'm concerned about these unintended consequences, and real estate is one of them. What do you think are some possible unintended consequences of the last four increases?
I'm not sure about the last four, but when you mentioned unintended consequences, I immediately thought of 1994 when we had a series of tightening moves that added up to 3 percentage points.
Yeah.
And Mexico during that year got into increasing difficulty holding on to the value of the peso, and so they were, to some extent, a victim of U.S. monetary policy.
That economy virtually collapsed down there, didn't it?
Yeah. There was a lot to that, but we added a little bit to their burden in the United States with our monetary policy. I suppose if you were tightening monetary policy very gradually and moderately, and it triggered a major stock market break, that would be an unintended consequence. Or it had some international repercussion. But over the years, our financial markets have been freed up and deregulated to the point where they operate fairly smoothly, much more so than before. And that may be one reason that it sometimes takes more tightening than it used to have a given impact. The markets are so good at channeling funds where they're needed.
I do think
so it's
that,
sort of a mixed blessing. You know, monetary policy used to react on housing much faster, more abruptly, but maybe you didn't have to go so far to get the intended effect.
Bob, we're going to take a break. Folks, it's 29 after the hour. Stand by. When we come back, I want to get Bob McTeer, president of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank, to talk to us about stock prices and what does the Fed think about those. Stay with us. We'll be right back. There is little evidence that the American economy, which grew more than 4% in 1999 and surged forward at an even faster pace in the second half of the year, is slowing appreciably. At the same time, inflation has remained largely contained. Those are the words of Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, and he made those comments to Congress, Bob McTeer, over the last week or so.
Right.
And when he says inflation remains largely contained, you know, we talked when you were here last. I asked you, what are the dragons you guys are trying to slay these days? If inflation is largely contained, what are you going after these days?
Well, I'm reminded, I guess, of a joke about a guy who jumps off a high building, and as he passes the 40th floor, and then the 30th floor, and then the 20th floor, he said, "Well, okay, so far." And in the Q&A session of Chairman Greenspan's Humphrey Hawkins testimony, he gave a not very good analogy, I think, and that is of a boat coming into a dock. But instead of sort of slowing down and turning as it approaches the dock, it just keeps going headlong and rams right into it.
Well, that seemed to be a little extemporaneous, didn't it? I got the feeling he hadn't practiced that analogy very long.
Well, one of the senators told him it wasn't a very good analogy, and he had to acknowledge that that was true. But that sort of gives you the way he's thinking about it. I mean, he does believe that inflation is contained, but he believes there's some forces in motion that, unless they're altered a little bit, will be very serious. And one of the most immediate that he's concerned about is the diminishing pool of unemployed workers that are available to be brought into this very rapidly growing economy.
Right.
Simple arithmetic tells him that that pool is going to run dry pretty soon, and then suddenly we will have all this momentum, and it will drive wages and prices up fairly abruptly.
Well, Bob, let me tell you something. Of all the things that Mr. Greenspan and you probably and the rest of the Fed folks are concerned about, in my opinion, that's one of the most valid, and I would have to agree 100% with that. And the thing is, I'm going to propose that what you said a minute ago, that's coming very soon, I'm proposing it's already happened.
Yeah, you get a lot of anecdotes about tight labor markets that really are almost unbelievable.
It's a crisis. I've said before on this show many times, this is not a problem, it's a crisis.
I guess you're aware that last year I ran in my annual report letter and then in an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal a suggestion for two things to do to help that situation modestly. One of them is to remove the penalty for Social Security workers,
yes,
recipients working. And the other was to lift the immigration cap on highly skilled workers that are needed in the high-tech area.
Right.
And I gather from reading the newspapers that Congress is on the verge of actually enacting the Social Security reform. I believe the Republicans are for it, and I believe the president has indicated he would be willing to sign it.
That must be done to get some people who want to work back in the marketplace. And I'll tell you what, another benefit we'll get there, another dividend will be to get some of our brain trust back. But another thing, the immigration issue actually came up in the Humphrey Hawkins Q&A.
Right. I was a little disappointed that the chairman wasn't more forceful in supporting it. He did support it, but he sort of pointed out that immigration has a lot of implications beyond the economic.
Right.
But, you know, I talk to people here in Dallas at Texas Instruments, and they have hundreds of jobs open that they can't find anybody to fill them.
Yeah.
We have the people to fill them, and they're in graduate schools in U.S. universities, and they're from foreign countries, and we aren't allowed to tap a pool, or the pool is very very limited.
Well, one of the things that one of the senators said to him was, you know, those people could be working here, raising their families, paying taxes, instead of doing the same work which they would be doing when they went back to their home in India or wherever they went.
That's right.
They because of the virtual capability that we have in the world today, those people can work anywhere. Why not leave them here?
We can employ them here or we can employ them there. And if we employ them here, the collateral jobs will go to lower-skilled U.S. workers. And if
right.
we employ them there, they'll go to foreign workers.
Absolutely. Let me read another quote. This is from the Wall Street Journal. The stock market's current decline. And as many of you know, the markets, the Dow went below 10 for the first time, what is it, about 10 months in the last few days? Something like that.
Yeah.
This is a quote from the Wall Street Journal. The stock market's current decline is just what Mr. Greenspan ordered in his quest to cool the red-hot economy, unquote. Thoughts?
Well, that may or may not be true. It involves some reading of his mind. I do think that there's an element of truth that people do worry about a bubble, and if you are worried about a bubble, it's a lot healthier to let a little air out of it early rather than let it pop like the Japanese bubble popped and led to a whole decade of malaise in the Japanese economy. I don't know if there is a bubble, and the chairman admits that he doesn't know either. His main concern with the stock market is sort of a scholarly concern over a fairly technical point, and it is that the rapidly rising stock prices have made everybody feel wealthier.
Yeah.
And to some extent, they are spending virtually all of their current income.
That's the wealth effect. Pardon me, I got to interrupt you. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We are back. 42 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. If you'd like to give us a call, the number is 888-822-8255, 1-888-822-8255. We're visiting with our friend Bob McTeer. He's the president of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank and a member of the Federal Open Market Committee. And that's the organization, that's the group in the Federal Reserve Organization that meets every 6 weeks or so to decide what's going to happen with interest rates. And your next meeting, Bob, is on the 21st.
Is that right? I never remember the name.
It's the 21st. It's Tuesday in about 3 weeks or so.
Yeah.
Bob, give us your Federal Reserve Bank's web address, please.
www.dallasfed.org.
DallasFed.org. All right, thank you. Go there and check that out, folks. I think you'll find it more interesting than maybe you would think it would be. You'll find a lot of information in there, a lot of quotes and some speeches by our guest this hour, Bob McTeer. And I'll tell you, one of the things I like about Bob McTeer is he's a very smart person. He's highly educated and very experienced in the matters that we're talking about. But when he talks to you and me, he talks about it in ways that the average person can understand. And, Bob, I congratulate you on that gift, and I want to thank you for sharing it with us.
Well, you're awfully generous.
Well, I mean that. I want to get back just for a minute and talk about the stock market a little bit, because I've got some economists and some friends and some Wall Street friends who would be unhappy with me if I didn't focus on the stocks a little bit. What is wrong with the stock market creating the wealth that it's creating? Why is I know we talked about the possibility of a bubble a little bit, but is there a bubble, or are there just new models that are being employed out there that maybe the Fed is not comfortable with?
Well, as the chairman points out frequently, you never know whether there's a bubble until you're looking back on it.
And yeah.
There's just no way to know in advance. And he's not really operating on the assumption very much that it's a bubble. His main concern over the stock market days is that people are feeling so rich and so well off that they're adding to their current spending to the point of drawing their current savings down to virtually zero.
Are you seeing that in the savings levels and also in the consumer debt levels? Is that that's how it manifests itself, isn't it?
Yeah, the personal saving rate, the way it was being measured, had gone below zero for a few months last year. And then on October the 28th, they did some revisions in the way they calculated it, and that raised that up to about 2%. But traditionally, the personal savings rate should be closer to 6 to 8%. So,
but Bob, does that take into consideration how much investing is going on?
Well, the technical definition of saving is fairly arcane, and an economy, when you say that an economy saves, what you're saying is they didn't consume all of the output that they're producing.
Mm-hmm.
And what's left over is defined on one side of the ledger as saving and on the other side of the ledger as investment. So ex ante, saving and investment turn out to be about the same magnitude.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and I do know that it just would seem to me that the more accurate, in my simple way of looking at things economically, it would seem to me that the more valid measurement of people of the wealth effect, so to speak, would be more on the debt side than on the savings side, the consumer debt side.
Well, whatever, the wealth effect is sort of interest, but it's not a big deal. It's not all that material, even if it's real.
Right.
One thing you've got to be concerned about when you talk about wealth, let's say that we're all sitting around and we own our stocks, and then tomorrow all our stocks are worth twice as much. Each of us feels wealthier.
Right.
Each of us is, because we can sell our stock and go out and buy real goods and services. But we can only do that if some of us don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what you've got is everybody with more purchasing power before there is more production to be purchased. So hopefully, as these stock market values keep rising, hopefully it's based on productivity rising so that the flow of goods and services in future years can grow to match that new level of wealth. Otherwise, it's not really wealth. I mean, otherwise, it's just
on paper
wealth.
It's just monopoly money. Yeah, but now one of the things that's kind of interesting is there's an interesting chain of events going on here with the difference in what's happening to the Nasdaq. I mean, Mr. Greenspan, absolutely, it seems to me and to most people, Mr. Greenspan got the Dow's attention last week, actually over the last week and a half or so. But it doesn't appear that he got the Nasdaq's attention. Nasdaq doesn't, it seems, our friend Chuck Cadlick with Seligman and Company out of New York, who was with us last week, said, as far as he can tell, that the Nasdaq is indifferent, that's his word, is indifferent to interest rates.
You know, the last time you and I talked, we were talking about the new economy versus the old economy, and I've noticed in recent weeks on CNBC and other financial shows, they are actually talking now openly about new economy stocks versus old economy stocks.
Right.
NASDAQ is sort of weighted with the new economy, and the Dow represents the old economy, and the stock market is reflecting this tremendous underlying transformation that's going on in the economy, from the old industrial economy to the information, knowledge, service, internet, Yahoo economy.
But what seems to me, though, if there is a bubble, if there really is a bubble, let's just say for the moment that one exists or could potentially exist soon, it's got to be in the NASDAQ rather than in the blue chips, in the Dow. It's got to be in the NASDAQ, and yet all the things that you guys are doing at the Fed doesn't seem to be affecting it at all. So it makes me worry that perhaps Mr. Greenspan, to the degree that he can influence you guys at the Fed, that he's going to do so much, he's going to try to do so much to turn the NASDAQ, to get the NASDAQ's attention, that a lot of the rest of the economy will be hurt. And now we go back to what I was saying in the beginning of the hour about unintended consequences.
Yeah. I don't really think he's trying to get the NASDAQ's attention, but you're absolutely right. Monetary policy is a very blunt instrument, and there's only one dial to turn there, and as you turn it, it has different impacts on different sectors. And this new high-tech economy that's emerging is much less reliant on traditional bank loans and relationship banking.
Yep.
It's much more fed by the capital markets, particularly venture capital. And while it's not totally interest rate insensitive, it is to a large degree, certainly relative to the Dow. So I think what monetary tightening is doing is sort of speeding up the churn a little bit, sort of accelerating the transformation of the economy from the old to the new.
What do you think we should do? I'm going to change the subject a minute, and we're going to go into a break here. I've just got about a minute. What do you think we should do with the surplus? Should we pay down taxes, or should we lower taxes or pay down the debt?
we ought to stall for a long time and be paying down debt and then eventually get to lowering taxes. A distant third would be spending more money on programs.
Well, that'd be, I would rather put that out on number fourth or fifth, maybe.
Yeah, right.
Well, the thing about it is, the problem with paying down the debt first is that means the money still got to go to Washington first. And that's what I worry about. And the truth is, I think that's what Mr. Greenspan worries about. In fact, he actually said that, essentially, didn't he?
Yeah, well, every time he testifies, one side tries to get him to agree with them about it, and the other side does, too. And he's been consistent over the years.
He has. Stand by, Bob. I'm sorry. I've got to interrupt. We've got to take a quick one. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. We're having an absolutely outstanding visit with our friend Bob McTeer. Bob is the president of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank. He's a member, one of 17. 17, right, Bob? And a member of the FOMC?
It's 17 now, but there's two governor vacancies. It's normally 19.
Ordinarily 19. Okay, so they're typically 19, and 7 at any given time when you have a full FOMC, Federal Open Market Committee, 7 don't vote and 12 do, right?
7 don't and 5 do.
Right, okay. So 5, I thought there were 12 total votes, though.
There are 12 presidents. At any given time, 5 of them are
five voted. Of the presidents, right? Okay, see what you mean. And the
all of the governors vote.
And all of the governors, okay. And there are 7 governors.
Normally,
yeah.
Right now, there are only 5.
I see. Okay. All right. I want to read a quote here, Bob. That one of your quotes, and I want you just to comment on that a little bit. This is a quote from Bob McTeer. I still have a fear of zigging when I should be zagging. It would be very bad to ease monetary policy just as inflation was about to pick up. It would also be bad to tighten monetary policy just as we're about to sink into a recession.
I hope you got a minute, because that requires a little background.
All right.
That came from a speech I made to a small business group here in Dallas, and I was talking about my early experience with small business was at my dad's truck stop when I was a teenager.
Right.
And I used to work there, and I worked nights mainly. And he kept telling me the trouble I'd get in if I ever put gasoline into a diesel engine or ever put diesel fuel into a gasoline engine. It would ruin it. So I was always scared to death I'd get that backwards. And at the same time, I was playing on the high school basketball team, and I had this nagging fear that someday I'd get disoriented and turned around and shoot the basket on the wrong end.
Wrong way McTeer, huh?
Right. So I told this group, I said, what does that have to do with monetary policy? Well, I've always had this lifelong fear of zigging when I should be zagging. And I went on to say that normally you don't worry about it with monetary policy. The question is, do you ease or not, or do you tighten or not? Do you zig or not, or do you zag or not? Rarely do you have a situation where you're discussing going both ways. However, the Asia crisis sort of raised a situation like that, and there was a period during that some people were arguing for tightening at about the same time others were arguing for easing. That's very unusual.
Would it be safe to say that for a period of, say, 6 to 12 months, beginning in 98 and maybe a little bit into 99, that the job that you guys had to do with the Fed has never been more intense and more complex?
That's certainly true during my tenure there. The Asia crisis came at a time when some people were already interested in tightening, and we didn't know what the net impact of the Asia crisis was going to be, and we had different views of what it might be. So it just sort of put everything into suspense for a while.
And then right in the middle of that, you had the long-term capital debacle.
Right, and I guess that was in October, and it was at about the same time Russians defaulted on their debt.
Exactly.
And so the combination of those things really seriously impacted our financial markets and led to those three easing moves in the fall of 98.
Well, I'm glad things have settled down just a little bit. They seem to have been, and you guys can focus a little more specifically on some of the specific problems we have here in the United States. Bob, that's got to be the last word. We're all out of time. Thank you very much. I know you've already agreed to come back and be with us in April. Good luck in the March FOMC, and do me a favor. Tell them not to raise rates.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Bob. Bob McTeer, ladies and gentlemen, the president of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank. Great friend. Got it to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners, because without your courage, hard work, and devotion to your dreams, America would not be the greatest country in the world. This is Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.